Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. It's L.A. Steele. Tonight we're going to, I don't know, what the hell. I had planned several things, but to talk about this evening. However, neither of them appeared to be. I had a tendency to forget where I was at here. Tonight we were going to discuss a few issues, but I really was not able to get everything I needed to discuss. I thought I had what I needed, but I did not. I'm still, if you're going to bear with me here, I'm still trying to find something. I'm at a complete loss. I apologize. Hang on one second. Tonight I had a book that I thought about reading. That was again, it's on Emerson, but it's called it's Brief Quotes. Interestingly enough, it's called Emphatically Emerson. And I had thought of working with this book tonight, and I'm not sure if I can do that. It's a pretty bizarre book, actually. I was trying to figure out how to exactly approach this, and I, from a complete understanding, but what it is basically, it's called Emphatically Emerson, and it's quotes of Emerson, and I'll start, and they're dated from the time he was. For those of you who aren't familiar with Ralph Waldo Emerson, I've done a lot of reading of his and of his stuff. And this particular book I haven't read yet on air, but it's really kind of fun. And if you're an Emerson liker, and it's kind of a book of journal entries taken from his journals writings over his entire lifetime. And there's some pretty bizarre excerpts or quotes that he has, and I thought I'd read them tonight in the context that they're written. And I'm going to start with the first with his first quote, and Emerson, as you know, is a great thinker. He was a great thinker, and his works are timeless. But at the age of 17, and he kept a journal his entire life. And this book is from his journals. And when he was 18. Or 17, rather. He wrote this entry. There is a strange face in the freshman class whom I should like to know very much. He has a great deal of character in his features and should be a fast friend or a bitter enemy. I thought that was insightful because whether he's talking about himself or, you know, talking about someone else. Aren't we all like that, really? Especially when we enter college. We don't know very much about ourselves other than what we like or dislike. I'd really very much like to know myself. I've always wondered that. And shall I become a friend, or shall I become an enemy to myself? And at age 17, that's quite profound. Here's another one that was written a few months later at age 17. I find myself often idle, vagrant, stupid, and hollow. This is somewhat appalling, and if I do not discipline myself with diligent care, I shall suffer severely from remorse and a sense of inferiority hereafter. All around me are industrious and will be great. I am indolent and shall be insignificant. Avert it, heaven. Avert it, virtue. I need excitement. I love this. I mean, you have to look at a 17-year-old's mind, especially a brilliant mind like Emerson. And you see what he said, and he said, I find myself often idle and vagrant, stupid and hollow. And so that's quite something to say to yourself, you know, about yourself. He said, this is somewhat appalling. If I do not discipline myself with diligent care, I shall suffer severely from remorse and the sense of inferiority hereafter. So he knew he had to tighten himself up a bit, and he knew he had to straighten out, but he says, avert it, heaven, and avert it, virtue. He says, ah, damned it, I need excitement. And we all do, especially at 17. Here's another Emerson quote at 17, a few months after that last one. He said, I claim in class for moments of respite from the irksome school to saunter in the fields of my own wayward thought. The afternoon was gloomy and preparing to snow, dull, ugly weather. But when I came out from the hot, steaming, stoved, stinking, dirty A to B spelling school room, I almost soared and mounted the atmosphere at breathing the free, magnificent air, the noble breath of life. It was a delightful exhilaration. He was 17 at that age. This is December 1820. He was 17 years old. A few more. And there's one more from at 17, which I thought was interesting. I am sick. If I should die, what would become of me? We forget ourselves and our destinies in health. And the chief use of temporary sickness is to remind us of these concerns. I must improve my time better. I must prepare myself for the great profession I have proposed to undertake. That's only, he was 17 years old then. And here, a year later, May of 1822, at the age of 18, he writes, in 12 days I shall be 19 years old, which I count a miserable thing. Has any other educated person lose so many years and lost so many days? And he was only 18 years old when he thought this and when he was thinking this, and that's the kind of genius he was. I wanted to mention that this book was called Emphatically Emerson, and it was written by, selected and arranged by Frank Crocitto, C-R-O-C-I-T-T-O. It was put out by Candle Power in New Paltz, New York. And it was put out in 2003. I happened to get a copy of this from the publisher himself. He was on my radio show back then. And it was fascinating. Fascinating book. I'm going to let me continue. These are all short, sweet little things that he said, but they're all quite interesting. In 1824, at the age of 21, in his journal, he wrote. Emerson wrote. Why has my motley diary no jokes? Because it is a soliloquy. Every man is grave alone. When I was 18, 19, I kept a diary. And it's a good thing to keep. I still do to the extent that I don't do it diligently every day, but I do keep a journal. And my thoughts, my writings, and a lot of them I put online. But it's interesting that, and I suggest anyone who doesn't do it consider doing one and follow your thoughts, you know, over the many years and how you form them. In December 1824, at the age of 21, he wrote this other thing, which was quite interesting. When a whole nation is roaring patriotism at the top of its voice, I am fain to explore the cleanness of its hand and purity of its heart. That's quite insightful, because we do that today. Knowing that our patriotic fervor is really, a propaganda push. I believe most people are patriotic to a large degree, but patriotism is something quite different than fighting for your country. In that way, it's standing up for yourself and standing up for your ideals and the ideals of your country. And in 1825, again at the age of 21, he wrote, "It is my own humor to despise pedigree. I was educated to prize it. The kind art and cares instructed my youth, and whom my God reward, told me oft the virtues of her and mine ancestors, but the deep sleep in their moonless night, my businesses with the living. But the dead sleep in their moonless night, and my businesses with their living." And I thought that was insightful as well, because we give so much credit to our ancestors, but we think about our lost, those we lost, and we lose sight so much of the living. We can become so morose and so stricken sometimes, or you know, that's all we think about, and we quote them, and we, you know, I remember when my father died back in, it was 1990 actually, it was quite a sad time, and I found myself I was driving back from Maine, where I'm from, and back from the funeral, and I remembered, I was driving back by myself, and I was thinking, about my father, and I was so absorbed in the thought of him that it was absurd, and I found my mother had given me some clothes, some old clothes, some of his newer stuff that he had that he hadn't worn. And I found myself in a shirt of his and a pair of shorts. And I was driving back, and it was in the summer. And I live in Connecticut, so it was quite a long drive. And I was driving along, and I really wasn't thinking much about it, about anything really. Just, you know, kind of sad, and thinking about thousands and thousands of memories of my father. And before I knew it, like subconsciously, I didn't realize, or consciously rather, I didn't realize what was happening to me until I got home. It's really like a 10-hour ride, you know. And I found myself, and I got out of the car, and I brought my stuff home into the house, and I was upstairs, and I went into the bathroom, and I looked at the mirror for some reason, and I was looking at my father. I was in his clothes. My face, I looked somewhat like him. And I realized that I had dredged up this. I had engrossed myself into this thought pattern for 10 hours, and possibly for several days that I was in the ball with it, to the extent that I physically began to resemble him. All right, I could see myself, and I wouldn't wear these kind of clothes. My father was, 65 years old. I was, 40. So it was like, the whole thing was quite bizarre. And this was something that I was involved that I wasn't. So that snapped me out of that. I snapped out of that quickly, and became myself again. But we can become so involved, especially in a situation of grief, or in a situation where you try to emulate those that you loved or those that you admired. And before you know it, you become involved with it. You subconsciously, you're not aware of it, but consciously rather, you're not aware that you're actually absorbing that personality, or you're absorbing the traits to the point where you're actually, are becoming that. So, but it says, but Emerson at 21 said, "But the dead sleep in their moonless night. My business is with the living." And that's true. The dead move on. The dead are gone. You gotta live. So, break away from your grief. A year later, in 1826, at the age of 22, Ralph Emerson wrote in his journal, "All things are double, one against another," said Solomon. "The whole of what we know is a system of compensations. Every defect in one manner is made up in another. Every suffering is rewarded. Every sacrifice is made up. And every debt is paid." And this is fascinating because he was only 22 years old, but he later wrote the Law of Compensation, based upon that principle, and based upon what he just stated here in his journal. And, and if you've ever read The Law of Compensation, it's a remarkable, remarkable work, essay. And it states that, for every debit, there's a credit. Cosmically, as well as physically. There is a balance that occurs. Cosmically, and regardless of how much you put out there, and it doesn't seem that it's ever coming back, it doesn't seem like, it seems like you're forever and forever just putting yourself out there and working hard and never getting ahead, really, and never, whatever, you're not breaking ground, you're not whatever it is. But in the concept of the law of compensation, we are compensated. We're not only immediately, but we are compensated in so many other ways that we neglect. Everybody thinks, oh, we should be compensated in, you know, money, you know, but that's not necessarily so. How can you compensate for a kindness? Or how do you compensate someone for a cruelty? Is that all, can it all be equated through finances? No. It can't. It really can't. But, you know, you have it in other ways. You have it, you get it through love, you get it through respect, you get it through admiration, you get it through all the other intangibles, if you will. But for every hour that you work for someone who promises to pay you, then you will, then, you know, you're working, you're establishing your own value, all right? Your own value. And my value, like, for instance, like tonight, am I getting paid? I'm receiving no compensation for doing this this program. No financial compensation for doing this program. So yes, well, if you're not getting any money for it, what are you doing it for? Honest to God, I can tell you I really don't know. Other than the fact that there's a great satisfaction that I get to knowing that I can read something that maybe nobody's ever heard of before. And possibly that one person out there, or 10 people, or 100 people, or 200 people that may tune into this program are suddenly getting something unusual that, wow, you know, maybe it'll change their life. I don't know. Or maybe it'll enlighten their day, or maybe it'll inspire something in them. And for that's a great feeling. That's a great reward. But for me, but at the same time, there is another avenue. There's another compensation. How can I place value, financial value, on what I might or might not be able to do for someone? I mean, a doctor can place his value and say, okay, you know, I'm charging you $25,000 for this operation. You know, whether you live or die, I'm gonna charge you $25,000, and hopefully you'll live better than you were, and you're gonna be fixed, you know. But in how can I? But if, let's say, a thought that I generate to you tonight inspires you to go on to create something incredible, you know, something remarkable. Or maybe just to relay some deep insight into your own psyche. What value is that? How can you place a value on that? I don't know. But just know that I share it as a gift to you, and knowing then the law of compensation and how that works, and the faith that I have in it, what I give to you tonight will come back to me in some other way. But it will come back. It definitely will. And whether it comes back to me immediately, or tomorrow, or the next day, or a year from now in some other form or some other way, if I inspire you, perhaps you or somebody else will immediately inspire me. And for that, you know, I'll be able to create some gain, you know, either spiritually or financially from it. And that's all we can expect. And that's the trade-off. That's the law of compensation in our lives, working in our lives. So that if we accept the fact that we are here and now, regardless of our situations, physical, mental, whatever situation it is, what kind of stress we're under, or what kind of problems we face, I don't know. But regardless, if there's something that draws you, and Emerson said, and I start my book actually with this statement, in the introduction of the first line, is, I wouldn't know, I wouldn't have it here with me, but I just thought about it, and I'll read it, and it's from the Oversoul, and it's O believe as thou livest that every sound that is spoken over the round world, which thou oughtst to hear, will vibrate on thine ear. And that was from his essay, The Oversoul, in the first series by Ralph Emerson. And I believe that because so many times, whatever is I'm meant to hear, I will hear. I know that. Whatever I'm to act upon, I will hear from some source, right? And react upon it, because for some reason in my own evolution, my own enlightenment of a spiritual consciousness, that statement or those words were meant to jar me, were meant to awaken me to some degree towards solving another issue, another problem, or to toward an understanding of a greater awareness. So, again, based on the law of compensation, every suffering is rewarded, every sacrifice is made up, and every debt is paid, one way or another. And at the age of 25, Emerson wrote, I deliberately shut up my books in a cloudy July noon, put on my old clothes and old hat, and slink away to the whortleberry bushes and slip with the greatest satisfaction into a little cow path where I am sure I can defy observation. This point gained, I solaced myself for hours with picking blueberries and other trash of the woods, far from fame, behind the birch trees. And he was only 25 years old, and he wasn't famous at that point. He wasn't well known at all. He was a clergyman, actually, but isn't it so true? I do this constantly. I love to be anonymous. I love to walk somewhere and be not known. Even though I live in a small community, that's very difficult. I'm on television, radio, and so on. But it's so interesting that for instance, I truly love to sit in my patio. It's nice out there. Lila's done a beautiful job with the flowers. I built this patio back about 5 years ago. And I truly, truly enjoy it. It's private, and nobody's there. And you can, it's just a nice place to be. In his case, he can walk around the woods or whatnot. I have certain ways that I just can be private and anonymous and, wear my hat, my straw hat, and sit there just soak up the sun, be lazy or be productive or whatever I want to be. But regardless of what I am, I'm by myself. And being by yourself being away from everybody, being out of the spotlight, wanting no attention whatsoever from anyone, ignoring phone calls, ignoring, you know, just forget about it. I'm not here. I don't exist. And I do that for my own sanity. And it gives me great joy to do that because it's just one of the exercises to gain sanity that we all have of some sort. We all do that, I believe. Some people do that. Although I had a friend once years ago, many years ago, who told me that he hated to be alone. He hated. He had a fear of himself, basically. I thought that was very strange for him to say that. Very strange. Billy was quite a. I liked him. I liked him. A confused man. With a strange street smarts, you know. And he understood some basic issues and philosophical issues. But he hated to be alone. He had a number of friends, but so he would bother them all. But I thought that was quite a statement, because there was nothing more that I enjoyed, even to this day, than being alone, being by myself. Not all the time, and not, you know, but just to be by myself. In a meditative state, doing whatever it is, you know, that inspires the soul, you know, inspires the mind, inspires me, just by walking or just sitting or, you know, by myself, without a book, without a music, without an email or computer. I don't think enough people spend enough time enjoying nature, enjoying themselves. I don't always enjoy myself. I have a lot of things that have to be done or a lot of pressures. But for the most part, I rather enjoy, I enjoy silence. I enjoy meditation. I enjoy the quiet of life, if you can get that. And you can get that at anywhere you are. You can get it driving. You can get it, you know, in your home. You can get it But I tend to rather thrive. Be one of those who tend to thrive on solitude. Anyway, I'm going to move on to another one here because, I think this is an interesting one. In 1830, Ralph Emerson wrote, and he was 27 years old at the time. I wanted to mention in this particular book, which is so neat about it, is it's a, everything is chronicled, so you see it from 1830. It says age 27, and you know his thoughts at that point. Now the last one was 1828. He was 25 when he mentioned that, how he liked to, you know, go out and pick blueberries and stuff and put on his old hat and just get away from things and become and hide behind the birch trees, you know. But in the next essay, in the next entry, he says, when a man has got to a certain point in his career of truth, he becomes conscious forevermore that he must take himself for better or worse as his portion. Now, there's more to this, but I think we must stop and analyze this, what he said. When a man has got to a certain point in his career of truth, he becomes conscious forevermore that he must take himself for better or worse as his portion, that what he can get out of his plot of ground by the sweat of his brow is his meat. And though the wind, though the wide universe is full of good, not a particle can he add to himself, but through his toil bestowed on this spot. It looks to him indeed a little spot, a poor barren possession, filled with thorns, and a lurking place for adders and apes and wolves. But cultivation will work wonders. It will enlarge to his eye as it is explored. That little nook will swell to a world of light and power and love. Isn't that? I mean, if that's not a remarkable insight at the age of 27 years old, I'm impressed. Because, yes, it's true. It's so true. A little education. I mean, what we are is what we are. Who we are. But I love the way he starts it. He says, when a man has got to a certain point in his career of truth, the career of truth is such a beautiful metaphor. Because in his career, he had studied to be a clergyman. He had studied to be a preacher, and so he was in his career of truth, in his career of spiritual truth, but also in his life. And Emerson was a very ambitious man in the sense that he saw a much greater potential, a much greater. Then he couldn't be locked into a podium in front of a small parish, and he saw much bigger than that, and he couldn't abide by the rules and the regulations of that, and the beliefs he felt were wrong, and yet if he criticized them, he was criticized and based on that, we have to consider what he was saying. I believe at 30 is when he got out of the profession and started to write and started to do other things. But his reverend position as a Protestant preacher. Which, thankfully to the thanks to him, the world has been a better place, and many, many millions of people have been enlightened by his work. But he had incredible faith, an incredible truth that, and like I said, in his career of truth, he looked for truth. He studied. He worked very hard, and he was very, very attached to nature, extremely attached to nature. In fact, his first essays, first series of essays were called Nature, and self-published, by the way. Which makes me laugh because my first book is self-published as well, Naked at the Mic. But very much so inspired by Emerson has always inspired me, as so many people have over the many years, and philosophers, songwriters, painters, artists, poets, thousands and thousands and thousands, and I say thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of different authors and different writings and different sermons and different philosophers and different historians and so on. I could probably say I've probably read, I stagger to think how many books I've read in my life. Thousands, just thousands. it's amazing that I still have a mind of my own. Maybe I don't, But let me finish this. My thoughts on this, and he goes on to say, "This is our meat." I wonder if there's. When a man has got to a certain point in his career of truth, he becomes conscious forevermore that he must take himself, for better or worse, as his portion. That what he can get out of his plot of ground by the sweat of his brow is his meat. So whatever his talents are, whatever his profession is, that is his sustenance, all right? Be it spiritual, physical, financial, whatnot, that is his sustenance. And though the wide universe is full of good, not a particle can he add to himself, but through his toil bestowed on the spot. In other words, clarifying this, and most of you don't need that explanation, but the way I see it is that's so true, is that through the wide universe is full of good, not a particle can be added to himself, but through his toil bestowed on the spot. So you can't add anymore. You can't expand yourself anymore than you can by yourself. Who you are, what you are, what you're endowed with, that is your machine, if you will, your mechanism to survive. And it looks to him indeed a little spot, and everyone looks at him, and you're only taking up like 2 feet of space, maybe 2 feet wide by 6 feet tall in this world, and it's very small. Very, very small. And it looks to him indeed a little spot, a poor, barren possession, filled with thorns and a lurking place for adders and apes and wolves. And, you could be sitting here, you could be sitting in your apartment right now listening to this. You could be in a very small room, rented room, or a college room, and listening to this, knowing that you have a very small spot in life, and you maybe think, God, I'm totally insignificant. But you're not. You're not. You're only as insignificant as you think you are. And you can always work out of that with your own imagination, with your own determination. And he says, but cultivation will work wonders. It will enlarge to his eye as it is explored. That little nook will swell to a world of light and power and love. And, that's what it's all about. You can take, I can tell you, like, right this minute, like this, I'm in a small studio, library. It's got hundreds of books and tapes and, computer, all kinds of machinery, that printers, radios. But the amount of space that it actually takes up and where I actually am is incredibly small in relationship to the rest of the world. It's like infinitesimal. But where I am in my mind is, and where I'm reaching is possibly reaching you, who are somewhere else. Maybe you're in a huge room, maybe you're outdoors, maybe you're listening to this on an iPod, maybe you're listening to this somewhere else. But it's reaching another person. It's there, and so it goes deeper, deeper and deeper, and broader and broader and broader, and it has no limit. The words, the just as Emerson wrote these words when he was 27 years old in 1830. I mean, that's 170 years ago, right? Maybe more than that. 170? No, it's 180. 180 years ago. He never thought that I would be sitting here reading this, you know, stuff that he wrote in his journal at the age of 27. But that's the way it works. That's the way it works. That's the way things spin and spin and continue. And truth, like he said, certain in his career, truth. When you speak truth, when you learn truth, when you devote your life to truth, then you are taking on a cosmic force that is serving you and uplifting you and bringing you to a higher level and bringing your thoughts and bringing your actions and bringing your words to a higher level, to a point where it moves out through the ether. And I can take these words written almost 200 years ago by a brilliant mind who sought the truth. And I can read them, interpret them into my own mind and soul, and relay them to you, who then in turn can move on from there. But that one thought, that one quest for truth inspires me, inspires millions, inspired the author here to take it out of years of work through researching Emerson's journals and deciding on this particular this particular entry, and then it coming to me, and then to you. This one, this particular one is very interesting, and it is short and sweet. But April 31st, at age 27 again, he wrote, Emerson wrote, "Trust to that prompting within you. No man ever got above it. Men have transgressed and hated and blasphemed it. No man ever sinned, but he felt it towering above him and threatening him with ruin." That's the, that prompting is the urge, the voice, but the urge that you have to move on, to do what you are supposed to do. And I don't mean this in a sense of destructive methods, you know, go out and get drunk, you know, you got the voices telling you to get drunk. No, what I'm saying is the trust to that prompting within you. Trust that prompting, that motivates, that intuition, that insight. It says no man ever got above it. In other words, it's constantly there, and it's God speaking to you. It's eternity. It's infinity. It speaks to you. No man has ever gone beyond it. Men have transgressed and hated, blasphemed it. Sure, they curse it because it's nagging. It's a nag. It stays with you. It's like, you know, you got to do this thing. You got to do this thing. You got to do this thing. You know, and it stays with you until you write it down, or you create it, or you do it. You know? And then it goes and move you, and you move on. But he felt it towering above him. But no man ever sinned, but he felt it towering above him, threatening him with ruin. That's fascinating. And when he was 28, June 1831, he wrote this. Heraclitus, grown old, complained that all resolved itself into identity, that thought was first his philosophy, and then his melancholy, the life he lived, the death he died. This is a quick, very quick statement. But in 2008, he wrote this. He said, "The things taught in colleges and schools are not an education, but the means of education." Interesting, huh? And December 1831, at the age of 28, he wrote, "I do not fear death. I believe those who fear it have borrowed the terrors through which they see it from vulgar opinion and not from their own minds. My own mind is the direct revelation which I have from God, and far least liable to mistake in telling his will of any revelation. Following my own thoughts, especially as sometimes they have moved me in the country, I should lie down in the lap of earth as trustingly as ever on my bed." In other words, I believe you must know what it means. I should lie down in the lap of the earth as trustingly as ever on my bed. So in other words, when you die and you're laid in the ground or whatever, trust death as much as you trust life. For the creator of death is also the creator of life. And it's just another transition. We move on, move along. We go from life to death. And yes, we wind up lying on the ground or cremated or whatever. But sooner or later, dust to dust, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. And we have to face the fact that we're not going to be here forever. And to some people, that's frightening. To me personally, it's not. I've reconciled with death many, 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 many years ago. I've seen it so many times in so many different ways, and I've come to terms with it. I actually see it more as a brother than I see it as a terror. It'll come to me when I'm ready for it to come to me, whatever it is, whether by accident, however it becomes. So here, let me move on. So we have to live and die, and live and die in the same faith. And he wrote that at the age of 28, and I find it quite profound that he had that great faith in God. December 1831, he was 28 again, still when he wrote this. "What are your sources of satisfaction? They are meats and drinks, dress, gossip, revenge, hope of wealth. They must perish with the body. If they are contemplation, kind affections, admiration of what is admirable, self-command, self-improvement, then they survive death and will make you as happy then as now." Isn't that remarkable? I mean, I mean, if you live your life in the pursuit of eating and drinking, gossip and revenge and wealth, that they perish when you die. Oh, that's gone. But if you believe in kind affections, admiration, self-command, self-improvement, then they survive death make you as happy then as now. You'll be as happy in death knowing that you aspired to be greater spiritually than ever than you were, you know, constantly aspiring. The next one, we're getting close to the end of our show, but the next one is called Books Are, he wrote this in December as well, December 1831, at the age of 28. And he said, books are apt to turn reason out of doors. You find men talking everywhere from their memories instead of their understanding. If I stole this thought from Montaigne, as is very likely, I don't care. I would have said the same thing myself. I should have said the same thing myself. So it's beautiful. So like you said, you know, if I'm reading this from Emerson, but by God, I should have said this myself. You know, I should have created this. You know, that's what he's saying. He says if I stole this thought from Montaigne, it is very likely I don't care. So, if I say I stole all of this from Emerson, he doesn't care, and I don't care, you know, and you don't care, because it all goes to the good, you know. And I may leave you with that one, unless there's something shorter, but... He was 28 again. Maybe I'll leave you with this one. The year hastens to its close. What is it to me? What I am, that is all that affects me. That I am 28 or 8 or 58 years old is as nothing. Should I mourn that the spring flowers are gone, that the summer fruit is ripened, that the harvest is reaped, that the snow has fallen? That is true. And I think I'll leave you with this last thought. He wrote this in February 1832. He was 28 again when he wrote it. Take nothing for granted. And one other thought that he says, don't trust children with edge tools. Don't trust man, great God, with more power than he has until he has learned to use that little better. What a hell should we make of the world if we could do what we would? Put a button on the foil till the young fencers have learned not to put each other's eyes out. And with that, I'll end the show. And again, that's emphatically Emerson. And you can get that, you might be able to get it on Amazon. And I thank you, and good night.